were challenged by Travis to die. By the line that he drew with his sword when the battle was nigh. Any man that will fight to the death, cross over. But if you want to live, you better fly. And over the line went 179. Hey, Sonnyetta, we're killing your soldiers below. That men wherever they go will remember the Alamo. His powder was ready and dry. Flat on his back, boy killed him a few in reply. And young Davy Crockett was singing and laughing with gallantry fierce in his eye. For God and for freedom, a man more than willing to die. Soldiers below, that men wherever they go will remember the Alamo. They sent a young scout from the battlements bloody and loud, with words of farewell from a garrison valiant and proud. Grieve not, little darling, my dying. If Texas is sovereign and free, we'll never surrender and ever with liberty be. Hey, Sonnyetta, we're killing your soldiers below. That men, wherever they go, will remember the Alamo.
Go, Santana, we're killing your soldiers today. Yeah, and all you wetbacks need to go too. Yeah, all you soldiers pick up a wetback, put one under each arm and head for the Rio Grande, because the ethnic cleansing boys are coming. Yeah, guerrilla radio calling. Yeah, insurgent radio, the insurgent radio network, the home of guerrilla radio. Colleague from the heartland in the bunker, September the 19th, 2008. And this is Freya's Day, Friday. Now, come on, boys, get those ladies out of the kitchen today, tonight, or sometime over the weekend. Take them out there and do the whirly gig on the dance floor or something. Yeah, have a good time. Buy her dinner. Get her out of the kitchen. Now, if she works in an office, keep her out of the office. You clean the house for a change. Yeah, we got Frank Bauer coming on here. And he's going to tell us more about guerrilla radio.
This is guerrilla radio calling. Guerrilla radio calling. I'm your host, Frank Bauer. And this is another episode of guerrilla radio, a subsidiary program of the Insurgent. And, I got a number of things to read today. I want to talk a little bit about interrogation. I think I'm going to jump right off with interrogation here. I got a little book here about military interrogation. I'm sure the police would use some of these tactics. And it's based off a book called Make 'em Talk by Patrick McDonald, Principles of Military Interrogation. All right, let's start it off. Actually, I'm going to pick this up in, the mid-paragraph here, save on time. Okay. It so happened that a compatriot of the source who worked for him was also in custody and in line for interrogation as well. Facts the source was aware of. We were able to convince the source that his partner was going to receive much worse treatment than he had so far, unless he immediately gave us full cooperation. It worked like a charm, but not until we had demonstrated our willingness to abuse his subordinate. You know, I feel that if you keep your group small, I feel that you will minimize the chance of you being infiltrated, and possibly the chance of you turning on somebody because of pressure. So let's read something else here. It says, self-protection is an integral part of interrogation. Your security measures can almost never be too cautious or far-reaching. Opposing forces have been known to allow one or more of their intelligence agents to be intentionally captured for the express purpose of gathering intelligence within the enemy's own intelligence network. These ringers can do untold damage to your interrogation system and intelligence network in general. Now, this could work. We could actually use this if the person that we have, use this as a means of misinformation. The person that does this, that allows himself to be captured, he's got to be a strong person. He's got to be mentally strong, not easily intimidated. Allow himself to be captured and to act like he's frightened, to act like he's just willing to sell out his compatriots for his own personal safety, but at the same time giving misinformation about who we are, what our intentions are, where we're located, and what we plan on doing. So this could be a really good thing to do. But then again, I wouldn't want to sacrifice one of my top guys for something like this, because remember, we want to keep our guerrilla bands, our insurgent bands, small. I believe that would work well in America, because, don't forget, I keep talking about the WASP, how one guy can infiltrate an organization, an institution, or a government, or a planet, or whatever, and just cause untold damage and destruction by just sowing seeds of chaos. That could be used against us. I give all these I read from the book Wasp, and we talk about James Mowry, but this can be used effectively against us. And it has been used against us. Why and how? Because it's been effective because of our COINTELPO, because we allow our organizations to get big. We recruit. We don't really have any hardcore security measures to keep informants out. And that's why these WASP-type tactics have been used against us, and they've been effective against us because we have all these organizations. And every one of these organizations has been penetrated by informants, by FBI undercover guys. Come on. We've seen movie after movie about how this FBI agent infiltrated the mafia, a la Donnie Brasco, how agents have infiltrated motorcycle gangs to bring them down. If you allow yourself under a government that's almost everywhere and almost all-knowing, I don't want to give too much credit to the system because they make a lot of mistakes too, but if you allow yourself to get big and allow yourself to be easily seen in the public eye, you're going to be infiltrated. There's no way you can stop it. But if you keep your group small, you don't advertise, except, in the means of propaganda, whether it's propaganda with a bang or whether it's propaganda with a ballpoint pen, if you keep your group small and you shut up about your activities and stop looking for credit, and stop looking for people to praise you because you had the balls to pull off something, you'll be around for a long time. So, let's read a little bit more here about military interrogation. All right. A classic example of this was the time I was assigned to interrogate an unconventional or special warfare operator. During his initial strip search, the guard noticed that he had tattoos on his arms and chest that indicated that he had unusual skills. One tattoo was of his military's parachute or airborne insignia. Others were of various designs, all associated with special military occupations. He even had a motto, turning the page, inscribed around one of the insignias that research had shown to be of a particular special unit involved with behind-the-lines work. Further research made easy by his information showed what schools he was likely to have attended in his home country. I went into the interrogation forearmed with this knowledge. Unbeknown to him, this gave me a formidable advantage and a sense of power. You know, we've talked about this numerous times about tattoos, but yet, you know, the word is, I feel the word is not getting out there. We keep getting these guys that are getting these tattoos, and basically you're wearing your ideology on your sleeve. And people, you know, a particular person out in the West Coast maybe wants to say that I'm a coward or a pussy for putting it the way I am. I'm a student of history, and I'm a realist. And I don't look at my government or my politicians with rose-colored glasses. I don't think for a second that, oh, they can't do this to me. I have my rights and this and that. Our governments, our system, our politicians are the most draconian on the face of the planet. I mean, they I would put them in the same boat as these, you know, these Arabs that'll chop people's heads off. They're just as ruthless. They use different tactics, that's all. But they create the illusion in this country that they serve us, that they're looking out for our best interests. And I don't want to, you know, go too much on what's going on with the financial thing that's going on in this country. But it's all a smokescreen. It's just a more elaborate smokescreen that was used against us in 1913 when we basically, you know, allowed the Federal Reserve to be voted into existence and the federal income tax. This is all, I mean, you know, we're going to be taxed more and more to bail out Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers and AIG and whatever, but we're also going to flip the bill on this new government program that's going to be like a safety net for all these financial institutions. Believe me when I tell you, I may not have the financial knowledge to articulate how this is being done, but we are being shafted. This is smoke and mirrors, and they're playing a game with us. And like I've said before with Tom Metzger on many shows, they will allow themselves to look incompetent rather than to look corrupt. These are not stupid people. They know exactly what they're doing. So don't play their game. Don't go on the street, you know, displaying a swastika and letting everybody know your idea. All you are is just being you're allowing yourself to be put on a list. And before this system, before this government really goes balls out for total power, absolute power, without having to hide behind the scenes anymore, you know, you're not even gonna see a warning shot. They're just gonna come knocking on people's doors and just escorting people away in the night. And if you think that I'm being melodramatic about this, that I'm, you know, that I've been reading too many books about the KGB, you guys have no idea how draconian our government can be. Louis Free, who was the director of the FBI, was taken on a tour of the interrogation cells and interrogation installations in Soviet Russia before, or actually right after the wall came down. And he went on a tour of all the cells where there been where a lot of insurgents had bullets put to their head or where people have been tortured. And Louis Free had the audacity to make the statement that America would have the problems that they have in crime right now if we would have had any of these type of techniques or institutions to do this kind of stuff. I mean, he actually, you know, said that there was a good thing that the Russian people went through under the KGB. This is the type of people we're dealing with. They don't give a damn about us. All they care about is their rich buddies and their bottom line. So stop getting tattoos. You're letting everybody know what you're about. This is the time that we need to swim in the sea of the people. This is the time that we need to go underground. This is the time we need to act like an anti-racist, you know, in certain settings. I don't see nothing wrong with going into a group, let's say an anti-racist group, acting like an anti-racist, making friends with anti-racists, and finding out where they live. Finding out all about them. Finding out where their family lives. You know, we don't have the balls to do this. I mean, the Tom Martinez walking around with breath in his lungs is a testimony to our lack of balls. And we need to overcome our lack of balls because some serious things is on the line here, namely the survival of our race. Continuing on with this interrogation book. The source is brought into the interrogation room and is allowed to sit and stew for a while, contemplating what is happening to him and, more important, what is about to happen. The interrogator enters the room and sits down opposite him, saying nothing whatsoever. The interrogator may wear a knowing smile or a grin on his face to further worry the source. And he may have a serious, peeved look. You know, he may, saying he may come in with a shit-eating grin on his face, or he may come in with a pissed-off look. You know, it depends on how they read you, how they can gauge your reaction to what's happening to you. For the word of source. Or he may have a serious look or a peeved look. While he is sitting there, the interrogator should be reading the source's body language, which may indicate if the approach is having the desired effect. Now, don't forget, this book is written to potential interrogators. It's not written from our perspective. This guy wrote this book to his fellow interrogators, talking about us, talking about insurgents. So, you need to know how they think, okay? Let's read another little story here. Actually, I need to start on the page before. Okay. It says here, the interrogator prepares a file with all the information he has on the source, even the little things that are of no great tactical value, but which lend themselves nicely to the scenario. All this information may only take up a page or two, but the source is made to believe that the thick file the interrogator is holding is filled with reams of data on his entire life and military service. Of course, the source only sees the back of the folder, not what is actually in it, which is blank paper and section tabs attached here and there to give a sense of a thorough a thoroughness and order to the file. The interrogator begins reading the file to the source, informing the source of various facts in his life. For instance, what weapon he carried, where and how he was captured, his unit and commanding officer, if known. This works well with the demonstrated omniscience approach. Trying to demonstrate that the interrogator is all-knowing, he knows what's going on, he knows everything about the source's life. Now, I'm going to harp on this, I guess, till I'm blue in the face. You keep your band small. For now, you keep your band small. And if you have a contact with another guerrilla source, you know, another guerrilla unit, I recommend that everybody in your band don't know the leader or the location where that other band is. I think only the leader should know. You know, we need to have a strict need-to-know policy put into effect. Not everybody should know everything. If it pertains to a certain mission, by all means, you may have to, you know, your buddy Joe Snuffy may get a bullet to the head and you have to take over, you know, his job on the mission. Maybe his mission was to search the POWs or search the dead bodies for pertinent information like maps, code books, radio frequencies, you know, personal information. You know, I'm going to talk about that in another show. But this is a ruse that the FBI, I know that the FBI has done this. In fact, there is one trick that I saw on TV the other day that I want to bring to your attention. They had a guy, they knew that he committed this murder. They had no proof on him, but they wanted to bring him in for a, quote, interview. Interviews are always interrogations. You know, they may not be twisting your fingernails out of your fingers or whatnot, but, you know, they've learned the gentle art of interviewing and interrogating. Okay, they don't have to physically hurt you to get information. One of the techniques they use, they get real close to you. They take away your personal space. They put you in a barren room, so there's no pictures on the wall for you to focus on, so you can tune out. Okay. But this one guy, who was, I believe he was on cold case files, they had pictures, all kind of pictures of this guy, of his childhood, of his graduation picture from high school. They had them all taped on the inside of this interrogation room. And they had pictures of the dead woman who was mutilated or murdered or whatever. They had everything about the pictures of the woman and pictures of the guy who was being interrogated. Pictures of the woman who was murdered. And they put him in this interrogation room and left him in there with all these pictures. And he's looking at all these pictures, and the cop rushes in. Oh, you're in the wrong interrogation room. You need to be in another one. Get out of here. Get out of here. It was all a ruse. He was purposely put in there, and they act like it was a mistake to put him in that room. And that was just to shake him up. And sure enough, the guy talked. You know, the old saying, if nobody talks, everyone walks. Too many people out there thinking that they can outsmart the police, that they can talk without really saying nothing. No, you can't. They go to highly specialized schools. They have all kinds of training in human psychology. You start talking, they are going to get you. Okay, so don't talk. All right. Let me flip through here, see if I can find something else that's cool to read. By the way, I bought this book at Paladin Press, so there may not be anything left in here. Okay, that's it. Well, not much. It's a thin book. It was like 80 pages long. All right, jumping right ahead, I want to check in on our buddy James Maurer. I think we're about to finish off some of the things that I outlined in WASP. I encourage the tactics of the WASP. If you don't want the tactics of the WASP to be used against you, then keep your bands, your groups, small. Okay. Pick it up here. Cautiously, Maurer took a peep around the corner. One cop was talking excitedly while the other scribbled in a notebook. It would be another minute before they returned, because they would close the hood and relock the car in order to bait the trap. Okay, the car that Maurer was driving was discovered. He parked his car, he went and did something. Remember, he's in disguise. He's not in a disguise that could be blown off or knocked off or taken off. But he's in a disguise, and he's going back to his car to get out of the area. And he sees the cops around his car, real excited, you know, like jackrabbits or whatever. And, you know, they're taking down the plate number, the VIN number, and they're just talking in the radio excitedly, and they're scribbling notes, and then they run away to basically observe the car from a hidden location. Okay, you got to remember, if you leave anything behind, you always have to assume that once you leave it behind, once you leave it locked in a locker, once you leave it parked on the street, there is the potentiality that it will come under observation. So, if you ever need to go back and retrieve something, be real careful. I said on a monologue a few shows ago to go rent the movie Get Shorty, which starred John Travolta and James Gandolfini, you know, Tony Soprano. go rent that movie, DVD, whatever, just for the purpose of how he wanted, how about John Travolta's character, Chili Palmer, wanted to check out what was in this locker at the airport. And he wanted to, he knew it was under observation, he knew it was under surveillance, but he wanted to really test the security. So go rent the movie just for that, because he used a pretty good technique. Okay, in order to bait the trap. Certain that no passerby would question something done with casual confidence, Maury tried the cruiser's door handle. It was locked. He had no key in which to open it and no time to pick it. And that put an end to any thought of taking one car in lieu of the other. Okay, I guess the reason why I outlined that is because, once again, I just got done reading a passage in this Make 'Em Talk about how they read your body language. You know, if you're in interrogation and you cross your arms and you start fidgeting with your feet, you're showing guilt. Avoiding eye contact, you're showing guilt, you know. So Maury, with casual confidence, walked up to the car to see if they walked up to another car to see if it was unlocked or see if he can get in it. But he didn't have time to pick the lock or anything. He was in a hurry to get out of this area. So remember, casual confidence. Whenever you go about your lone wolf activities, looking furtively over your shoulder, that attracts attention. You know, that looks suspicious in the eyes of people. Okay. Check out something else James is up to. After 5 hours, he struck a narrow lane and followed it to a clearing in which were a small sawmill and a dozen cottages. Before the mill stood two powerful trucks. From the shelter of the trees, he regarded them enviously. From the shelter of the trees, remember, always use your environment. Remember what I talked about on a few shows ago, Mentee. Remember, under the for the T, the super terrain, Akoka, observation of fields of fire, cover and concealment, obstacles, key terrain, and avenues of approach. I'm going to, you know, refer back to that many times. I want to beat that in your guy's head. Observation of fields of fire. Can I be seen from where I'm at? Where can I best observe my enemy? Cover and concealment. You don't want to stand out in the open. You want to hide in the shadows of trees. You want to hide in a ditch, in a gully. You want to use the lowest ground possible to move from point A to point B. You don't want to crest high ground because you create the chance of silhouetting yourself against a background, whether it be the sun setting in the west or the sun rising in the east. You never want to silhouette yourself going over a fence, going over a wall, going over a tree stump. You always want to keep the lowest profile you can. Okay? And so, carry yourself with casual confidence in your endeavors. Have a seemingly lack of interest or maybe even a bored appearance about you. You know, I saw this video one time, and there were these security agents of an installation that was looking on their cameras, you know, because that was their job. They had to pan the cameras around looking for things. And there was this guy they noticed. He was pacing off the distance from one wall to another, looking over his shoulder cautiously. I mean, that was a dead giveaway. Then they called in the units, and they apprehended the guy. After interrogation, they found out that he was sent in there to mark off the distance between one installation building to another, because he was part of a cell that wanted to blow up the building. You gotta do things casually. Every time you go about your lone wolf activities, always have in your mind that somebody is watching you. Either you're being picked up by you just happen to come into the frame of a home security camera that just happened to be looking on the street, a bank camera, a camera that's on a grocery store. You know, you may think, you know, there's no cameras around. I don't see no obvious cameras on the streetlight that I can do what I can do what I want, dressed the way I am. Always conduct yourselves with the inevitability that there could be a camera watching you. So that, what does that mean? That means wearing clothes that are uncharacteristic of you and that hide your personal features, if you have tattoos or whatever. You know, I'm known for the way I walk. People can know that it's me walking if I'm 500 feet away, even though they can't see my facial features clearly. They know it's me because I have a very distinctive gait about me. You know, they called me, when I was going through basic training, they called me Ape Man. You know, they said I kind of walk like an ape. And, you know, other people said I walk like a gangbanger or a homie. I don't know how I walk. All I know is I got a bad posture when I walk, and it's very distinctive. And I know that about myself. So you need to know that about you. So if I ever do anything, I'm going to make sure I alter my gait. I practice putting something under surveillance. I practice following people. I practice checking out the inside of a building and making sure that I can observe a camera without looking directly at it. I practice altering my walk. You know, you got to do this now under calm conditions, so you'd be more prone to do it under a stressful situation like a Mad Max type of society in America. So, continuing on here. After 5 hours, he struck a narrow lane. I read that. Nobody was near them, speaking of the truck, at the moment. He could jump into either one of them and tear away with no trouble at all. But the news of the theft would get the entire hunt on his trail. Right now, he had no idea speaking of the secret police. Sorry, guys, the lighting in where I do these shows is terrible, and there's nothing I can do about it. So, but the news of the theft would get the entire hunt on his trail. And right now, speaking of the secret police, had no idea where he'd gone to or where he was heading. It was better to let their ignorance remain his bliss. See, if he would have stolen the vehicle, that would have pinpointed his location and probably where he was going to drive to. So he was better off staying on foot. Okay? Something to learn there. Okay, reading on here. Returning to the front, he sat at the counter. The only other customers in the place were two ancient Syrians. Remember, these Syrians are not from the country Syria. They're from the planet that revolves around Sirius, which is a sun. Don't forget, this book was written in 57, so they didn't know a lot about the Sirius constellation, whatever constellation Sirius is in at that time. Okay, two ancient Syrians. Guzzling at one table, and too intent to bother with the newcomer. A burly character in a white coat appeared behind the counter and eyed Maori with faint curiosity. What do you want? Maori told him and got it. He set to forcing himself to eat slowly because the other was watching. He was eating slowly, he was acting nonchalantly because he didn't want to stand out in this guy. It's bad enough that this guy was watching him, okay? So he's acting nonchalantly like he has no care in the world. And he's making sure that he's eating slowly. Now, something else I want to point out that I forgot on a show last week, or the Real Radio show. All right, it's nighttime. You took my advice about your key thing and had your one car key on a quick-release keychain holder. Just on one ring, you have your one car key, you have your whatever you're going to do on your lone wolf op. You're not dressed in camouflage, which if you bump into someone, that's going to stand out. But you're dressed in earth tone colors, not brightly lit colors, not fluorescent, not pink and white and stuff like that. You do what you got to do. You DD-mile back to your car. Now, if there are people watching you back in your car, you need to act with casual confidence, okay? And when you drive away, don't peel off. That attracts attention. You need to drive away slowly like you don't have a care in the world. I can't tell you how many crime documentaries I've watched where Everything was going fine until the guy got in his car and peeled away. And when the police came around and they canvassed the area, they're like, well, do you see anything suspicious? Yeah, I saw this Dodge Charger peel away in great haste, 15 minutes after the explosion or whatever. That attracts attention. I don't know if I said this the other day about how Timothy McVeigh got caught, but he was, all this human activity rushed towards the explosion, and the helicopter above saw one car speeding away out of town. So that's how Timothy McVeigh was caught. So I don't know if I covered that the other day, but... eating solely because the other was watching. Finishing what he had to eat, he ordered the next item and disposed of it in the same bored manner. Body language, if you don't watch it, if you are not cognizant of it during an interrogation, during a police interview, during a lone wolf op, if you are not cognizant of your body language, you know, how many times on these monologues have I talked about Chevy and Shane Kehoe? If they would have just drove by that cop with casual confidence, not glanced back at him, you know, if they were just maybe act like they were laughing and jaw-jacking with one another, the cop would have paid him no mind. Okay, well, that finishes Wasp. But I do want to read the back of the book. Check this out. Back of the book says this: we want you to become a Wasp, said the Secret Service man. See this picture. Four men dead, a car smashed, all because a tiny insect was buzzing around. A tiny insect which caused panic, destruction, and death. Under the right circumstances, one man can shake a government. We want you to be that kind of Wasp, asked Mowry. You want me to be that kind of Wasp, asked Mowry? All right, I volunteer. We knew you would, said the Secret Service man. Says, it was an unorthodox way to fight a war, especially an interplanetary war. That could be interracial war. I don't know if I read this. I hope I'm not repeating myself. But sometimes war can be more effectively fought that way. So they trained James Mowry intensively, altered his appearance by surgery, and sent him off across the void to Jaimic, which was that planet revolving around Sirius, the 94th planet of Sirius, and to stampede an empire. Come on, guys. Get the vision. If you have white power tattoos and you have the mental constitution and the intestinal fortitude to do this kind of stuff, I recommend you get your tattoos altered. It's just too expensive to get the tattoos lasered off your body, and you can't get them lasered off in one sitting. You know, you got to... go back for more, and that could be expensive. So if you have the Celtic crosses, you can get them, you know, disguised into something else. You're not selling out your race. You're going undercover, and you're keeping your band small, and you don't go off half cock and doing things that without planning. Come on, man, our race is in some serious trouble here, and there's nowhere else we can turn to. Our race is under assault in New Zealand, Australia, Canada, Europe, and the United States. You know, Arthur Kemp, who wrote the March of the Titans, I never bought the book, but I actually read the book online. Stormfront.org used to have the book online. And I spent months going to a library, reading the book online. And there was one section how the demographers, you know, people who study demographics, are stating that by 2090, that's what, 82 years from now? By 2090, only 10% of the population of Europe will be white if the current trends continue. Now, these non-whites, they are a cancer. They are a virus. They are a plague, and the overwhelming majority of them are social parasites. And if you want a massive die off, you don't have to go out and kill these people. All you have to do is subvert the system they are leeching off of. The system that you are paying out your ass in tax dollars for. They are taxing the shit out of you, working class white man, to pay for their... They're growing them like... They're growing out whites like they're in a fucking incubator. You know, I work with this Mexican. Well, I did work at this job. I don't work at that job anymore because I only worked there for a short time because I wanted to get a better understanding about certain things. Everyone thought I was making a career move by taking this job. I don't give a fuck about this job. I wanted to learn some things. That's all I'm going to say about that. But I was working with this Mexican. He's like, and he said a number of times in 1 week, and I think it was like 3 different locations. Man, we Mexicans, man, we know how to make some babies. Man, that's one thing Mexicans can do. They can make some babies. And finally I said to him, I said, yeah, you guys breed irresponsibly. What do you mean? He's, you guys outbreed the ability of the natural resources around you. You know, white people stopped having big families long ago because we knew, for one, we can't afford them, and two, it would be better on the environment that we kept our families small. Well, you know, I don't remember the guy's name. He was the president of Indonesia. And he said in front, he said at an assembly in his own country one time, he said that we need to increase our baby-making ability. I don't remember the phrase he used, but we need to make more and more little Indonesian babies, and we need to flood America and Europe with our offspring. How dare they have such a rich and affluent society when we don't have anything? You know, it's like they want to leech off the hard work, the ingenuity, the technological abilities of the white man. Hey, you know what? It's time that we turn the Asians loose and say, hey, you guys, you're on your own. And I guarantee you, if we left them alone and didn't bother them for 100 years, we had no contact with them, and then we visited them again 100 years later, they may have made some strides, you know, but they would still roughly be maybe at the same place they are now. But I think maybe white science has so saturated the Asian countries that maybe they may be able to make some strides, but I don't know. But I think that we need to start looking out for number one. We need what William Pierce called hard-headed altruism. We need to look at a starving African baby in Africa and say, I don't give a shit. Because the more you help them, like Nietzsche said, what has caused more harm in the world than the follies of the compassionate? So, we need to harden ourselves here. Okay, I don't mean to get preachy there, but I just... certain shit just pisses me off. I'm going to read some things here from 150 Questions for a Gorilla. Question. What should be done with the slower gorillas in the unit? Answer. A separate slower unit is formed in which the men maintain more or less the same pace. Now, if you have a group of insurgents and you have some people that are, you know, they're in their 50s and 60s, these guys have no business being on an op with you guys if you guys are going to be running and gunning or doing whatever. The older, the more mature members of a guerrilla band, they can be sources of information. They can feign loyalty to the system or to the invading army and feed you information, you know. But I don't recommend them the more slower and older gorillas to be running and gunning out in the woods with you guys or in the cities, you know. Okay, question. Who should be the captain of the band? Answer. The captain is chosen by the band for his qualities of leadership, his character, intelligence, caution, and his enthusiasm for the revolution. I said the other day, mission, men, and me. If you want to be a leader in this struggle, if you want to be a leader of insurgents, you have to put the mission first, you have to put your men's welfare before your own, and then you take care of yourself. Question. Should the guerrilla know the succession of command? Answer, yes, he should know and respect it. There should be no arguments over who exercises the direction of the unit, or whoever is in command should be respected by all. You know, I want to talk about something here. And I want to talk about the NSM. Now, I've met some guys at the NSM. I know for a fact, I have it on good knowledge, that Bill White, who is in the American National Socialist Workers Party, a subgroup that broke off of NSM, this guy on his website put Jeff, Commander Shep's, Jeff Shep, who's the commander of the NSM, who they moved their office from Minneapolis to Detroit, put his, I guess he had a falling out with, Bill White had a falling out with Jeff Shoup or Shep, however you pronounce it, and put his address on his website. Shame on you, Bill White. Bill White also found the address of a juror who was in the Matt Hale trial, who voted guilty and was part of the guilty plea to put Matt Hale in prison. Found out the juror's name and address and put him on put the name and address on overthrow.com, Bill White's website. Put the juror's address on overthrow.com. Bill, you are fucking around. I mean, that's not good stuff, bro. I mean, I met Bill White at a Hitler celebration in Lyons, Illinois on April 20th. And I came on the show the next week and talked about it with Tom. And I said, you know, Tom, it's no real harm me going to this. The FBI in Chicago, they have a very good idea who I am. They know who I am. They've interviewed me many times or tried to interview me. And, you know, so I went with it. They took my photograph. It's nothing out of the norm. They expect me to do stuff like that, even though I don't belong in any organization. And even though I recommend that you don't join organizations, I met a guy at this thing, and I said, hey, you know what? You need to not come to any one of these ever again. You need to not get no racial tattoos. You need to keep yourself low profile, bro. You're doing yourself a great disservice by joining any organization. So I was glad I was able to plant that seed there. But I met Bill White there, and he's a smart guy. You know, I respected him as a man, and I respected him as somebody who wants the best for the white race. But you know what? All this infighting you see in the struggle, it's all these guys who are not adhering to this question I just read. Who should be the leader of a guerrilla band? And then the answer was the most educated, the most enthusiastic for the revolution. You know, all these guys want to be Indians, but all these guys want to be chiefs, but no one wants to be an Indian. Too many chiefs and not enough Indians, and that's always been the problem with the struggle. Everybody wants to, you know, to be the leader. They want to be the top guy. And if you form any kind of underground insurgent group, I recommend you read a little bit about psychology. You know, if somebody's in this for their own vainglorious thing here, I wouldn't put them in a leadership, and I would definitely not trust them with pertinent information. Because if they're only in this for themselves, I guarantee you the feds can turn them, or an occupying army can turn them. So we don't want them. We'll use their services by all means, no problem. Just like we'll use the services of the Aryan Brotherhood, we'll use the services of Nazi lowriders. We're not going to hold it against any of these guys. I have no bad opinion of any of these guys. I don't care if they're trafficking drugs. I really don't care at this point right now. You're talking about Frank Bauer. You should be promoting honor for the white race. Listen, we are being exterminated. And just because we are not being machine-gunned into tank ditches don't mean that our race is not in jeopardy. So, I don't care anymore. If somebody wants to be a racist and somebody wants to be an insurgent and a criminal, then by all means, dude, I don't care what kind of criminality you're into, as long as you're not a pedophile, as long as you're not raping women. If you're not doing those two things, but you're involved in other stuff, I don't have a problem with you. I don't care if you're shipping guns, selling drugs. I don't care anymore. I'm through trying to save this society, you know, or trying to warn white people. I love my race, but I want them to wake up, and there's no way they're going to wake up if their lives are comfortable in this country. We need to see ourselves as destroyers. We need to see ourselves as agents of chaos. And if you don't agree with me on this, then you need to walk around your neighborhood. Maybe you live in an all-white area and you think everything's just fine. You know what? Take a ride through Detroit and the surrounding suburbs and Chicago. Take a ride through Cincinnati. Cincinnati's becoming a nigger shithole. Memphis is gone. Forget about Memphis. I mean, that city is just gone. It's just been niggerized. Little Rock, Arkansas? Hey, maybe 50 years ago was a nice town. It's a shithole now. Montgomery, Alabama? It's a shithole now. I saw this episode of Gangland about this gang called La Gran Familia in Atlanta. And basically, it's the merging of five gangs in the Atlanta area. Latin Kings, Brownside Locals, or whatever they're fucking called. I don't care what they're called. An MS-13. And how they're just, fucking shit up in Atlanta. It's not blacks that are doing this in Atlanta. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of black criminal in Atlanta, but these Mexicans, I mean, the Mexicans are pouring into Atlanta. They're pouring into the Southeast. And eventually they're going to butt heads with the blacks, and we don't care about that. But come on, I mean, we need to have a sense of urgency about this. I was supposed to get the war and the flea, but I think maybe I will. I was going to read something else, but I guess that maybe I should read some things on a war and a flea, since this is my base book. Okay. Picking up here. Here it may be well to observe that, to the very great extent, the guerrilla fights, as they do because they must, their situation determines their course of action. Lacking the heavy weapons and the disciplined divisions with which to fight conventional military campaigns, they are confined, as von Clausewitz puts it, to nibbling at the edges of the opposing army and fighting in the enemy's rear area. Materially unable to face a military decision, they must of necessity await a political decision. In a revolutionary situation, political decisions will tend to favor their side, since these will come in the course of a protracted war which the enemy is neither politically or psychologically able to stand. Whatever the condition of his military forces, General Giap analyzes the situation of the French. He says, the enemy will pass slowly from the offensive to the defensive, the blitzkrieg. I wonder if the Vietnamese general actually used the phrase blitzkrieg, because that's a German phrase. And you guys know that. The blitzkrieg will transform itself into a war of duration. Thus, the enemy will be caught in the dilemma. He has to drag out the war in order to win it, and does not possess, on the other hand, the psychological or political means to fight a long, drawn-out war. Giap, of course, proved to be correct. Political pressures in France, the low morale of pro-French sector of public opinion in Vietnam, and the sagging morale of the troops themselves as the war dragged on, seriously weakened the efforts of the Expeditionary Corps. The country was swarming with guerrilla militia. Units were organized in virtually every village. Viet Minh regulars were making rapid force marches through the jungle to strike a French column here, a small garrison there, and were rapidly arming new units with weapons seized from the enemy, as well as heavier equipment smuggled from China. Well, we're not going to have any outside support, and you British insurgents, you're not going to get any outside support. And you Serbian and French, you French people, I hope there are people in France listening to these shows, but you people need to wake the fuck up, man, because France is dying. Charlemagne is turning over in his grave. I mean, he fought, tooth, fang, and claw to keep the Moors out of France, and you guys are letting them in by the millions every decade. Shame on you, France and England. In America. The country was swarmed with guerrilla units organized in virtually every village. Vietnamese regulars were making rapid force marches through the jungle. I read that. Okay, by the end of 1949, the French had lost the initiative and the Viet Minh had seized it to such an extent that the latter were unable to launch a limited offensive with 15 battalions, sealing off the part of the Red River Delta and the Tonkin from the Thai Highlands. In the spring, a larger offensive was launched against French defenses in the Red River Valley, and by the summer, the entire northeastern corner of the Tonkin had been converted into a Viet Minh stronghold. Interesting. Well, I'm running out of time here. I got too long-winded. Sorry about that, guys. But, man, we need to start kicking some ass. But we need to do it in a smart way. I hope you guys are training. In the meantime, you know, Tom Metzger always says, don't get your powder dry or keep your powder dry. It's not time yet. You know what? You could be training in the meantime. You could be training in...
And don't forget, guys, that the caliber of bullet that is the most ubiquitous caliber on the face of the planet is the 9mm. All law enforcement and military agencies pretty much throughout the world are switching and have either switched or is switching over to 9mm. So you guys need to be, I highly recommend the Glock 19 or any kind of Glock that shoots a 9mm because Glocks don't require a whole lot of maintenance. They can fire when they're dirty. But you guys need to be doing some training. You guys need to be learning how to fight with a stick, knife, and gun. You guys need to know how to disarm a stick, knife, and gun. You guys need to be working out in a manner that has functional exercises for combat fitness. You don't want to gas out in the middle of a stick fight, knife fight. You don't want to gas out in the middle of fighting two niggers at once. You know, especially if you guys are in your 30s. These 18, 17-year-old niggers can go all night, and you can't anymore. So you guys need to work on that. Get that fat off your body. Stop eating the sugar. And the very least we could be doing during this time is training. 14.
Well, there he goes, the man of the hour. Thank Bawa. Well, everybody knows it's not his real name. Let's just call him Lone Wolf Guerrilla Radio Man. Lone Wolf Guerrilla Radio Man, and forget that Frank Bauer stuff. I think he got that off a tombstone someplace. Hey, this is show B for Friday, Freya's Day. And, you know, last night I saw quite a bit of the moon left out there. It was beautiful. Came up in the east here in the heartland. It was about two-thirds or better. Oh, it was beautiful. I could almost reach out and grab it. We'll see you tomorrow. Two shows tomorrow. Guerrilla Radio Man and West Coast. West Coast, the Lone Wolf Man. I get my tongue wrapped around my tonsils.
In a little cabaret in a South Texas border town sat a boy and his guitar, and the people came from all around, and all the girls from there to Austin were slipping away from home and putting jewelry in pot to take the trip to go and listen to the little dark-haired boy that played the Tennessee flat-top box, and he would play. Couldn't write or wrangle, and he never cared to make a dime, but give him his guitar and he'd be happy all the time. And all the girls from 9 to 90 were snapping fingers, tapping toes, and begging him don't stop, and hypnotized and fascinated by the little dark-haired boy that played the Tennessee flat-top box, and he would play.
Then one day he was gone, and no one ever saw him round. He vanished like the breeze, and they forgot him in the little town. But all the girls still dreamed about him and hung around the cabaret until the doors were locked. And then one day on the hit parade was a little dark-haired boy that played a Tennessee flat-top box, and he would play.
It's true. Yes, it is. It's true.